ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Norman, we all know how much you love talking about your knee and osteoarthritis, and we're all following this journey with great intensity.
We're limping along with it, yeah.
We're limping with you.
Thank you.
There's a review suggesting that maybe exercise ain't all that when it comes to osteoarthritis.
Yeah, it's really interesting review. It's got some Australian researchers in it. And look, I must say that my experience is actually doesn't fit with that. If I don't do exercise for a couple of days, I get knee pain. And if I cycle to work, it's magic.
Mm. So you're not throwing out the Pilates and the cycling?
I'm like a new man, yeah. So I'm not yet. But, you know, what's one person's anecdote versus this mountain of evidence? We'll sort it out on this week's Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan, limping on Gadigal Land. Also on the show, gout is more common than you might think. It's not just the old man in the 18th century with his sore toe. It's often undertreated, and that significantly increases your risk of heart attack and stroke.
It used to be thought that low-dose aspirin could reduce your risk of cancer, but a new study suggests that's not the case in older adults.
What's in the news, Priya?
There's been some research around menopause that's been published in the British Medical Journal, and this has looked at the impact of menopause hormone therapy, or MHT, as people might know it, on your risk of dying.
Yeah, I suppose this comes from the Women's Health Initiative a few years ago, which suggested that menopause hormone treatment can increase the risk of breast cancer, didn't affect the risk of coronary heart disease, but created a lot of problems, and we're kind of coming back to a balanced view of it. And this study suggested that menopause hormone therapy does not increase overall death rates. But it wasn't, just before women get too excited about this, it wasn't a great study.
Well, let's break it down. I think it's important to break it down because this is a study that is observational in nature. So they've used a really quite big set of data from, well, it's a Danish registry.
And explain the word observational. So it's not a clinical trial where you're testing it versus placebo. You're just watching large numbers of women and see what happens to them compared to similar women who might not have been on menopause hormone therapy.
So women were included if they were aged 45 and they were alive. They were removed if they'd ever had a clotting disorder, liver disease, breast, ovarian or endometrial cancer, or if they'd used menopause hormone therapy before. And they were followed up for quite a while. So they started on their 45th birthday, and then for 14 years they were followed up, and they took into account factors like their income, their birth country, the number of children that they've had. They ended up with just over 876,000 women. A lot of women, and just over 104,000 of them had redeemed a script, so gone and filled a script for menopause hormone therapy. Couple of things, because you're saying that there are potentially some flaws here. One was that the mean duration of menopause hormone therapy in the study was only 1.7 years.
Which is next to nothing.
Yes, I don't have patients on it. Like, people are stopping it if it's not quite managing their vasomotor symptoms or their hot flushes or whatever we're trying to treat.
Which is the main symptom that is helped by menopause hormone therapy.
Yes, and it's quite effective. We should be really clear that for some people, menopause hormone therapy is really great for managing vasomotor symptoms, vaginal dryness, mood symptoms. But this was only 1.7 years, and there's been some criticism that it doesn't take into account people's weight or smoking status. And those are certainly factors that can impact someone's cancer or clotting risk, and that hasn't been captured in the data set.
There's also a risk in these studies of what's called the healthy user bias, which means that people who take menopause hormone therapy might actually be healthier to start with. And that's where a lot of the problems with misunderstanding about menopause hormone therapy emerge, particularly in the United States, where the observational studies they did were people sometimes in wealthy retirement villages and who were going to do well no matter what. And it was this bias in those studies. And there was other weird things as well, which is that the average age of death in this study was far sooner than actually women do die. So basically, it is likely that menopause hormone therapy is not going to increase your risk of dying, but this is probably not the study to tell you.
But also we should be really clear that, yes, it doesn't appear to increase your risk of dying, but that high-risk women, so women who do have a history of clotting or who do have a history of cancer, are not captured in this, and so we really can't comment based on this particular study. I think it's important to point that out, that this is for lower risk or general population.
It's reassuring and likely to be true, but we need to other research just to nail it as we go through.
And if you're into the images in journal articles, I felt that this one was particularly superior. Did you think? Did you like the visual abstracts?
I
love them.
Oh,
that's how I digest information. Do you read? I read all the text, but I need the pictures,
Norman. I'm not into cartoons with medical research.
They're not cartoons, they're diagrams. They were particularly nice. If anyone wants to look at the show notes, go and have a look at them.
Goofy didn't appear in the...
No.
So in the last few days, the Centre for Disease Control, which is actually, you think of that as an American institution, but actually now, as of this year, there's an Australian institution called the Centre for Disease Control with actually a couple of hundred employees, and they've taken over the reporting on antimicrobial resistance. So when we're talking about antimicrobial resistance, we're basically talking about antibiotic resistance, but also antifungal drug resistance, antiviral drug resistance. It's a huge public health issue. And whilst this is not a global report, it's on the Australian situation, the Australian data suggests that we're doing okay, but there is a rise in multi-resistant organisms, and there we're not doing that well in appropriateness of antibiotic prescribing, particularly in hospitals. And there's a challenge that we need to face, even though overall, compared to other countries, we're not doing too badly, but particularly middle and low-income countries are doing very badly, and we spoke about that last year. And remember, this is an infectious disease that people can actually spread antibiotic resistance person to person because it's carried in these little phages, these little viruses in your bowel. So, you know, this is a global issue, both in terms of humanitarian and social responsibility, but also in terms of self-interest. Now, there is an initiative called the Fleming Initiative after Sir Alexander Fleming, who basically discovered penicillin. And the Fleming Initiative is actually a London-based initiative, Imperial College London, to promote sensible use of antibiotics and reduce this issue of multi-resistant microbials, which at the moment are estimated to cause well over a million deaths a year. On the line is Alison Holmes, who's in Australia for an antimicrobial resistance conference. Alison Holmes runs the Fleming Initiative. Welcome to the Health Report.
Hello there. It's really, really great to be here. And, you know, the Fleming Initiative is celebrating a great Scottish doctor who discovered serendipitously penicillin whilst he was working at St. Mary's in Paddington. And he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1928 for this. But of course, it wasn't just the discovery. It needed to be made available. And that is why it involves several other people as well as him. But all of medicine depends on it. And we've kind of squandered this incredible resource a little bit, Norman, haven't we?
Well, it didn't take too long for penicillin for resistance to show up. And almost every new antibiotic, that's come onto the market, very shortly you get antibiotic resistance. So this is a global issue. And there's lots of things that we could talk about. But this week you're announcing an initiative which is about globally to teach children about antimicrobial resistance in schools. Why?
Well, absolutely.
They're not going to be the prescribers, or maybe they're going to be the prescribers in the future.
They will be the prescribers in the future, but actually they should be the agents of change. And very much like, you know, how the young and adolescents can all help us with dealing with issues about the environment and climate change, they also should be the agents of change and awareness about what it means to be able to access safe and effective antibiotics for now and for the next generation. And although this is something dear to our hearts, it was also highlighted in the UN General Assembly meeting in New York in 2024. And there's a high-level recommendation that this should be part of the curricula globally for primary and secondary schools. So there is an awareness of how important it is for you and your family and you growing up to make sure we use antibiotics wisely and remember they're a fantastic resource. And that's not just about antibiotics and making new ones. It's actually about using vaccinations, preventing infection, water, sanitation, hygiene. What can we do to minimize unnecessary exposure to antibiotics? So when we need them, they can be effective.
So if your dad and mum are a small farmer in a low-income country, your child might start complaining about them using antibiotics to improve the growth of their goats.
Or completely, or reinforce the need for anything that would prevent the use of them, such as hygiene, the use of vaccinations, and the understanding. I mean, you pointed out that, you know, every antibiotic used will drive resistance. Well, of course, you know, it's Darwinian evolution. And there needs to be the awareness of that and how they are something that should be treasured. And the other thing is, I mean, I'm sure on your program, you kind of talked about the phenomenal advances in terms of immunotherapy, advances in oncology, advances in transplantation. All of this will be completely undermined because these vulnerable people, when they're on those drugs, if they get infection, if it's resistant, it kills you. So we're not going to be able to make the most of the incredible advances in medicine and even the most basic ones, such as, you know, safe surgery, if we're not able to treat infections or prevent infections from happening.
So you're hoping for mass behaviour change?
Absolutely. And start young.
I'm just wondering what it actually looks like, though. How do you actually do this with children? Is this going into schools? Are these programs, books? How does it look for kids?
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing is what's so important here, the people that work in, you know, infectious diseases and microbiology are no good at this. And that's why it's been working with leaders in education and working with kids so that the best practice in embedding it in primary and secondary schools can be applied. And I was listening earlier before you were criticizing cartoons, I think. Anyway, visualization is really, really important. And visualization with appropriate language that is meaningful is absolutely critical.
Priya, thank you, Alison. Yeah, we love to hear it.
Yeah, Priya loves you. Alison, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Alison Holmes is Professor of Infectious Diseases at Imperial College London and also runs the Fleming Initiative. And there's also a story around on intermittent fasting. They've done a review of the evidence.
Yes, they've done a Cochrane review, which is, of course, where they look at all the studies that exist in a certain area. This included 22 studies with nearly 2,000 participants, and it was from countries like North America, Australia, China, Denmark. The takeaway, Norman?
And so we just should explain here. So we're talking about the different kinds of intermittent...
We're going to tease the takeaway. Go on.
Well, no. Just what is it, which is the various kinds. You can actually fast overnight, 16-8 type thing, or, you know, every out of a week, 2 days might be at 500 calories, and others more normal, you know, more normal diets. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
So you have a fasting window where the intention has been, and certainly it's very heavily touted on social media, that you put your body into starvation mode and it accesses and breaks down the fat and you get ketones. That's the intention behind it.
Does it work?
Well, the Cochrane review suggests no, that this intermittent fasting had no clinically meaningful effect on weight loss compared to either just standard dietary advice or no intervention at all.
Really? So no weight loss, no significant weight loss over time?
And also people didn't get an improvement in quality of life. There was really no difference. So the takeaway is really that there's not enough robust evidence here to tell people to go and not enjoy food for large periods of time.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I could never sustain
we should say it was only up to 12 months. So we don't know about the longer term potential implications. Most of the studies only went up to about 12 months, so maybe beyond that. But at the moment, I say listen to your body and your intuitive eating cues.
And watch your portions.
Yeah, and eat your rainbows. You could keep putting things in.
Yeah. Now I know where the rainbows come from. It's all these cartoons you're looking at.
Yeah, that's right.
You're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National.